So I want to start today by asking you, the listener, to just think for a second about the physical ground beneath your own chair right now.
Yeah, the actual dirt under the floorboards.
Exactly, because we tend to view property as, I don't know, static, right? Like, it's just geometric shapes on a plat map.
Just lines on paper.
Right. But today, we are taking a deep dive into a stack of deeply researched family biographies. Specifically, we're looking at the Phillips and Plunkett families of Hendricks County, Indiana.
Which is a fascinating set of documents.
It really is. And we are using their 340-year narrative not just to, you know, look at a dusty family tree. We want to understand the absolute brutal physical mechanics of how American history actually happened to the people who managed to survive it.
And survival is definitely the operative word here. I mean, we are tracing the evolution of a single piece of Indiana farmland.
Right.
You start with the untamed frontier, and then you move through these massive demographic migrations of the 18th century. Then you hit the devastating biological plagues of the 1850s.
God, the 1850s were rough.
Brutal. And then the psychological costs of the Civil War. And finally, we land on the heavily mechanized, industrialized farming of the 1960s.
It's a lot of ground to cover, literally.
It is. The dirt under our feet is basically a ledger of everything that occurred. And this specific farm acts as a perfect microscopic lens for the macro shifts in American history.
And there's this one immediate hook in the sources that just blew my mind, like a staggering coincidence.
Oh, the dates?
Yes, the dates. Yeah. So on January 23rd, 1683, a man named George Phillips steps off a ship called the Endeavor of London.
Right into the frozen banks of the Delaware River.
Exactly. He arrives as an indentured servant. And then, exactly 231 years later, to the exact day, January 23rd, 1914, Wayne Allen Plunkett was born.
The modern anchor of the story.
Right. These two men who anchor the beginning and the 20th century culmination of the story, they share a birthday across three centuries.
It's wild. It really frames the whole deep dive perfectly. Because to understand the layers of this specific Indiana farm, we have to track the demographic shifts that even brought the Phillips family there in the first place.
So let's start with George Phillips, our 1683 arrival.
Yeah. So he serves as indenture. He marries Patience Griffith, and he becomes an early settler of Bucks County, Pennsylvania.
And he does pretty well for himself, right?
He does. He dies in 1740, leaving a 300-acre estate, which was substantial.
Right. But his descendants don't stay there.
No, they don't. His grandson, John Phillips, relocates the family south to Stokes County, North Carolina, right around 1789.
Okay.
And then, by the early 19th century, John Samuel Phillips moves them again, this time north to Wayne County, Indiana.
See, this geographic bouncing around is what fascinates me. You establish a successful 300-acre farm in Pennsylvania, only to just abandon it for North Carolina. And then you abandon that a generation later for the absolute untamed wilderness of the Indiana Territory. I mean, it defies basic economic logic to continuously leave established, cleared, arable land for the raw frontier.
It defies economic logic, sure, but it perfectly aligns with theological logic.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Okay.
Because this is crucial.
Right. So the Phillips family belonged to the Society of Friends.
The Quakers.
Exactly. And the late 18th and early 19th centuries presented this profound moral crisis for them down in the American South. The agrarian economy of North Carolina was increasingly, basically inextricably linked to chattel slavery.
So this migration out of North Carolina wasn't driven by, like, soil depletion or just the search for cheaper acreage?
Not at all. It was a mass moral exodus.
Wow.
Yeah. The theology of the Society of Friends viewed the inner light of God as residing in every single human being, which obviously made the institution of slavery an absolute theological impossibility for them.
Right. You can't own another person if you believe they carry the divine light.
Exactly. But living in North Carolina meant your tax dollars, your local markets, your community infrastructure, it was all subsidized by slave labor.
It's systemic.
Completely. Yeah. You couldn't buy goods or sell your own crops without participating in that economic web in some way.
So they're essentially voting with their feet to escape a compromised system, like a massive slow-motion relay race where the baton is a set of moral values.
And a plow, yeah. Tens of thousands of them did this. They packed up and moved along the Great Wagon Road, heading north and west into the territory governed by the Northwest Ordinance of 1787.
Because that ordinance explicitly forbade slavery.
Right. So they initially clustered in Wayne County, Indiana, near the Ohio border, before pushing further west into Hendricks County.
Which brings us to Eli Phillips Sr.
Right. Born in 1805.
So Eli arrives in Clay Township, Hendricks County, in 1834. And the records say he purchases 160 acres of woods. And I really want to stop on that phrase for a second.
160 acres of woods.
Yeah, because the modern conception of a forest, especially for you listening, is basically a state park, right? With walking trails and little plaques. What did the central Indiana ecology actually look like in 1834?
It was terrifying.
Right.
I mean, it was a climax community of old growth, deciduous timber.
Which means what, practically?
We are talking about white oaks, black walnuts, shagbark hickories that had been growing completely undisturbed for 300 or 400 years.
Wow.
The canopy was so dense that early surveyors literally reported perpetual twilight on the forest floor at noon.
You couldn't even see the sun.
No. And the trunks were frequently 4 to 6 feet in diameter. Mm-hmm. The root systems were just these interconnected subterranean fortresses.
And Eli Phillips is facing this without internal combustion. I mean, no chainsaws, no bulldozers.
Nothing like that. He has a felling axe, a crosscut saw, maybe a team of oxen if he's lucky, and just sheer caloric output.
It's mind-boggling.
The biological mechanics of clearing that land are staggering. You don't just walk up and chop down a 5-foot-thick oak tree.
So what do you do?
Often they would girdle the trees.
Girdle them?
Yeah, cutting a deep ring through the bark and the cambium layer all the way around the trunk. You basically kill the tree slowly. The canopy dies, the leaves fall off, and that finally allows sunlight to reach the soil.
Leaving a field of massive, dead, standing timber, that sounds like a nightmare.
It was, which you then have to eventually fell, chop into sections, and burn. They would hold these log-rolling bees with neighbors, turning the timber into massive pyres that burned for days.
Just to get rid of the wood.
Yeah, filling the Indiana sky with just perpetual smoke. But felling the tree is only half the battle, because the root ball of a mature oak can weigh several tons.
Okay, wait. How do you pull a 3-ton root ball out of the earth with 1830s technology?
You dig a massive trench around it by hand.
By hand?
By hand. You sever the lateral roots with an axe, you wrap a massive forged iron plane around the taproot, and you're using a team of oxen to just brutally leverage it out of the ground.
That is just, I can't even imagine the back pain.
It was an agonizing, multi-year war of attrition against the biome, just to plant a single row of corn. Eli Phillips earned the title of pioneer citizen through basically guaranteed musculoskeletal damage.
And he wasn't doing it alone, right? Because the historical records show this deep interlocking community survival mechanism.
Yes.
Because Eli marries Margaret Cosner. They called her Peggy in Indiana. But the Cosner family had already been intermarrying with the Phillips family back in North Carolina decades earlier. Like, an Anthony Cosner married a Katie Phillips in 1799.
Right. This wasn't just individuals moving. This entire community uprooted and migrated as a contiguous unit.
Because you cannot survive the biological reality of the frontier as an isolated nuclear family.
You die. The sheer physical labor required a communal labor pool. You needed those neighbors for the log-rolling bees.
So while Eli is fighting the forest in Clay Township, the specific plot of land that will eventually become the Plinkett Farm is being settled right next door in Marion Township. But the timeline of Hendricks County settlement is geographically kind of strange. Marion Township was the very last township in the county to be settled. Why is that?
Well, it really comes down to hydrology and topography.
Hmm?
Hendricks County was organized in 1823, and early settlement naturally followed the easiest paths of resistance.
Like rivers.
Right. Navigable waterways and established indigenous trails. Townships with larger creeks or more manageable terrain were claimed first. Marion Township, sitting right in the central western part of the county, was slightly more isolated.
Less water access.
Exactly. It was heavily timbered and lacked the immediate geographic advantages of the surrounding areas. It was basically the deepest, darkest part of the interior woods.
The final pocket of resistance.
Precisely.
And the two men who push into this final pocket are George Washington Turner and Paul Fott. The township histories place them arriving together as co-settlers between 1828 and 1832.
Yeah.
But the legal documents, the actual federal land patents, aren't issued until 1835 and 1837. So there is this massive multi-year gap between when they arrive and when they legally own the dirt.
Yeah, and that gap represents the concept of preemption, or what we'd call sweat equity.
Okay, explain that for the listener, because it's a really wild concept today.
So the federal government, operating under the land ordinances of that era, desperately wanted the interior of the country populated and productive. But frontier farmers rarely had hard currency.
They were land rich and cash poor, or not even land rich yet.
Exactly. So the normalized practice was to just move onto federal land, build your log cabin, begin that brutal process of girdling and burning the timber we just talked about, and prove you could survive.
You're just squatting, essentially.
Legalized squatting, yeah. You improved the land's value through your own physical labor before you ever paid the local land office for it.
But you're risking years of physical destruction on the hope that you can eventually secure the title before some wealthy speculator from the East Coast buys it out from under you.
It was a massive gamble.
Yeah.
But in the mid-1830s, George Washington Turner finally makes that legal plunge. He travels to the federal land office in Crawfordsville.
Okay.
And on September 16th, 1835, he secures certificate number 22,122 for 40 acres.
And then he goes back later, right?
Yeah. On March 18th, 1837, he secures certificate number 22,501 for an additional 80 acres.
And that 80-acre parcel is the exact plot that anchors the modern Plunkett Farm.
That's the one.
What really strikes me is the demographic reality of this transaction. Turner was born in 1812. So he is only 23 years old during the first purchase.
And 24 during the second.
A 23-year-old legally securing a permanent foothold in the expansion of the United States. How does a kid that age manage this without, you know, modern banks or a mortgage?
Well, the mechanics of that purchase were entirely analog and very literal. You didn't secure a loan from a central bank. Andrew Jackson's specie circular of 1836 eventually mandated that government land be paid for in hard currency.
Gold or silver.
Exactly.
Mm.
Paper money issued by wildcat banks was virtually worthless on the frontier. So Turner is walking or riding a horse to Crawfordsville, carrying a heavy leather pouch of actual physical silver coins.
Wow.
At a standard rate of about $1.25 an acre, he is handing over a massive sum of physical wealth that he and his family probably scraped together for years.
And in return, he gets a piece of paper.
But not just any piece of paper. He receives a document that connects him directly to the executive branch of the government. The 1835 patent is physically signed by President Andrew Jackson.
That's incredible.
And the 1837 patent is signed by President Martin Van Buren.
I mean, just think about the psychological impact of that document arriving at a dirt floor log cabin in Marion Township. A 23-year-old frontier farmer holding a piece of vellum signed by the President of the United States.
It completely shifts your identity.
Right. You go from being a temporary squatter fighting the wilderness to a permanent, recognized stakeholder in an expanding empire.
And Turner deepens those roots quickly. He marries Catherine Fott, who is the daughter of his co-settler neighbor, Paul Fott.
So the two families merge.
Yeah. The 1830s and 40s represent this period of massive demographic optimism for them. They are producing children, clearing more acreage, and finally transitioning from mere survival to actual agricultural productivity.
But, and this is where the story takes a really dark turn, the fragility of the frontier reasserts itself in the 1850s in just a horrifying way.
It really is.
We have to examine the biological nightmare that hits the Turner and Fott families.
Yeah, to give some broader context, the 1860 United States Census mortality schedules give us the macro data on this.
Yeah.
In 1850, the nation recorded about 9,500 deaths from a specific bacterial infection. By 1860, that number had spiked to over 26,000.
A massive jump.
And the epicenter of this epidemic was a cluster of Midwestern states, Indiana, Ohio, Illinois, Iowa, and Kansas.
Uh-huh.
Indiana's death rate was actually 75% above the national average.
And the disease was scarlet fever.
Yes. Caused by Streptococcus pyogenes.
Which is the exact same bacteria that causes modern strep throat.
The exact same group A strep bacteria, yes.
See, today strep throat is, you know, an annoyance. You go to a clinic, you get a swab, you take a course of amoxicillin, and you're back to work or school in 48 hours. The concept of it being a mass casualty event feels entirely foreign.
We have completely forgotten the terror of bacterial infections prior to the discovery of antibiotics. In the 1850s, the medical community didn't even have a functional germ theory of disease yet.
They still believed in miasma theory.
Right? Yeah, exactly. They thought bad air or foul vapors caused illness. But scarlet fever is highly virulent. It's transmitted via respiratory droplets. Coughing, sneezing, or simply sharing the confined airspace of a 19th century log farmhouse during a freezing Indiana winter.
What is the actual biological progression of the disease in a child back then without antibiotics?
Well, the bacteria colonizes the throat first, causing massive inflammation, swelling, and just agonizing pain. But the real danger comes from the exotoxins the bacteria releases into the bloodstream.
Okay.
These toxins cause the capillaries to break down, resulting in that characteristic bright red rash that spreads across the chest and body, hence the name scarlet fever.
Right.
The body responds with a dangerously high fever. And in severe cases, the toxins damage the heart valves, the kidneys, the central nervous system. A child would seize, slip into a coma, and basically die of toxic shock.
It is a brutal, brutal way to die. And the epidemiological timeline on this specific farm is just a textbook example of a lingering bacterial reservoir. The Fott family is dismantled systematically over 3 years.
It's heartbreaking to read the records. The timeline begins on April 4th, 1857. An infant daughter is born to the Fott family and dies on the exact same day.
Because a newborn has no developed immune system.
Right. If older siblings or parents are asymptomatic carriers, the infant is exposed the very moment it takes a breath in that cabin.
And then 10 months later.
Right. On February 3rd, 1858, 9-month-old Orlando Fott dies. Now notice that Orlando was born around the exact same time the first infant died.
So the bacteria never left the household, it just waited.
Exactly. Then there is a gap. A full year passes. The family probably thinks the absolute worst is behind them.
You'd hope so.
But on May 19th, 1859, 5-year-old Mary Josephine Fott dies. She had survived the earlier waves, but the 1859 outbreak catches her.
And finally, on April 15th, 1860, 2-year-old Laura Fott dies. 4 children, just gone in sequence. I mean, just pause and think about the psychological terror of living in that house. You are watching your children burn with fever, their skin turning red, and there's absolutely nothing you can do.
You have no medicine. You have no understanding of germs.
You just watch them die, bury them in the dirt you cleared with your own hands, and wait for the next winter to see who gets sick next.
And the physical toll of nursing 4 dying children over 3 years completely destroys the immune systems of the adults, too. Less than 2 weeks after the 2-year-old dies, the 67-year-old grandmother, Elizabeth Fott, dies on April 26, 1860.
Wow.
And exactly 1 month later, her 73-year-old husband, Paul Fott, dies on May 26th.
Paul Fott, the co-settler of the entire township.
Yes. Because while scarlet fever predominantly kills children, the exotoxins are perfectly capable of killing elderly adults whose immune responses are completely compromised by exhaustion, sleep deprivation, and the sheer biological stress of unimaginable grief.
They were just broken.
The 1860 mortality schedule would list the official cause of death, but there were casualties of the epidemic regardless.
So by the summer of 1860, there are 6 fresh graves in the family cemetery on the farm.
It's a staggering loss.
The family is utterly hollowed out, but the macro timeline of American history offers absolutely no reprieve. Because the scarlet fever epidemic ends just as the calendar turns to 1861 and the entire country tears itself apart.
Right. The Civil War demands its own physical toll from the survivors of this exact land.
Tell us about George P. Turner.
So George P. Turner is the son of George Washington Turner and Catherine Fott. He grew up watching his cousins and his grandparents die of the fever. He survives the biological plague only to enlist in the Union Army in 1861. He's 23 years old.
Which is the exact same age his father was when he signed the land patent.
The exact same age. He serves for 3 years, dies in February 1864, and is shipped back to Hendricks County to be buried in the exact same farm cemetery.
Next to his grandparents and the little kids, the concentration of grief on this 80-acre plot is just staggering. But the Civil War impacts the other family line we're following, the Quaker Phillips family, with a completely different kind of devastation.
Yeah, we really need to look at what happens to the sons of Eli Phillips Sr. during the war.
Right, because they go to fight too.
They do. Eli Phillips Jr. joins the 51st Indiana Infantry. He survives the horrific combat at Shiloh and Perryville, but he is killed in action at the Battle of Stones River on January 1st, 1863. He was 24.
God. And his brother?
His brother, Israel Phillips, joins the 54th Indiana Infantry. He survives his deployment, musters out, and then dies just 2 weeks after returning home in October 1862.
So that's two sons dead in a matter of months.
But it is the third brother, William Wesley Phillips, who is the grandfather of Sarah Phillips, by the way, whose story really reveals the absolute psychological and theological trap of the Civil War for this family.
Okay, let's get into this, because this is where the history gets so complicated.
So William Wesley enlists in 1865 in the 148th Indiana Infantry. He actually survives the war, but he returns permanently disabled. He eventually requires crutches for the rest of his life.
And the cause of his disability is profoundly unglamorous. It wasn't, you know, a mini ball at Gettysburg or shrapnel. It was basically the complete failure of military logistics.
Exactly. The pension records indicate he contracted severe rheumatism from sleeping on the damp, frozen ground at Camp Carrington in Indianapolis.
Just from the cold.
Because he was never issued a uniform overcoat. The exposure to the elements permanently damaged his joints. He eventually filed for an invalid pension in 1886, and he received $30 a month for his suffering.
A lifetime of chronic pain for a bureaucratic failure. But the physical destruction is only half of William Wesley's tragedy,
right?
Because he is a Quaker. We established earlier that the entire reason this family is in Indiana in the first place is because their theology demanded they flee the slave economy of the South.
Right, but that same theology demanded strict, absolute pacifism.
Right.
The Society of Friends views all war, all violence, as a violation of the divine light.
So you have this agonizing moral paradox. The systemic evil of slavery has triggered a continental war. Do you take up arms to violently crush the institution your family sacrificed absolutely everything to escape? Or do you maintain your pacifism while other people fight and die to end human bondage?
It's an impossible choice.
Yeah.
And William Wesley chose to fight.
And what were the consequences?
The theological consequences were absolute. The records explicitly state that upon his return to Hendricks County, he was formally disowned by the Mill Creek Friends meeting.
He is basically excommunicated.
Completely cut off. He sacrificed his physical health to the Union Army, and in return, he was stripped of his religious identity, his social network, and his entire community standing. The war didn't just take the lives of his brothers. It fundamentally fractured the spiritual foundation of the survivors.
That is just a brutal cost of conscience. I mean, you can't win.
No. And after enduring the deaths, the plagues, and the war, the 19th century pioneers eventually just let go of the land. George Washington Turner sells the farm, which is now 200 acres, in 1880, to a man named John Underwood for $9,000.
And the Turners move west to Iowa.
Right. Which brings us across the threshold of the 20th century. The land remains, but the technology and the economics of how that land is utilized are about to undergo a radical transformation.
Enter Wayne and Sarah.
Exactly. In 1936, a young man named Wayne Allen Plunkett marries Sarah Frances Phillips.
So the descendants of these pioneer families finally merge. Wayne and Sarah are the 20th century stewards of this narrative, and their agricultural timeline intersects with the next global conflict, World War II.
But unlike the Civil War generation, Wayne does not deploy to a combat theater. The historical context here points strongly to an agricultural draft deferment.
Which makes sense because the logistics of global warfare had evolved.
Massively. The United States government recognized that an industrialized war machine requires an industrialized caloric output.
You have to feed the army.
You cannot feed millions of deployed troops and the civilian populations of your allied nations if you conscript your entire agricultural labor force and send them to Europe.
Right.
So the Selective Service System implemented strict classifications. If you are the primary operator of a farm producing essential crops or livestock, you are classified as 2C or 3C. Your national duty was to maximize crop yields, not carry a rifle.
But the economic reality of how Wayne and Sarah farmed in the mid-20th century is highly complex. They didn't just inherit the Turner land free and clear.
No, not at all.
The chain of title for this specific farm is honestly a convoluted masterclass in the realities of tenant farming.
It really is. So let's walk through the sequence. In 1937, the land is purchased from the Underwood family by a man named Herschel H. Holtzclaw.
Okay, so Holtzclaw owns the farm.
Yes. Holtzclaw holds the legal deed to the dirt. Wayne and Sarah Plunkett want to build an agricultural enterprise, but they lack the capital to purchase the land outright.
So what do?
They enter into a rental agreement with Holtzclaw.
So they're tenant farming. You provide the labor and the equipment, the owner provides the land, and the profits or crop yields are split according to whatever the contract says. It is the primary mechanism for young farmers to build equity.
But the arrangement is not permanent. In the early 1950s, Wayne and Sarah actually leave the farm. They move into the town of Danville. We know this because the 1950s city directories confirm Wayne Plunkett's residence right in town.
So the economics, or maybe family dynamics, shift, and they are off the land entirely. This is the crucial mechanical detail of the title history that we need to get right. While the Plunketts are living in Danville, Herschel Holtzclaw, as the legal owner, leases the farm to a new family.
Right, the Chandlers.
Yes.
The Chandlers become the new tenant operators. And it's important to note this was a direct contract between Holtzclaw and the Chandlers. It wasn't Wayne and Sarah subletting it.
But the Plunketts aren't finished with the farm. In the late 1950s, Wayne and Sarah return. They move back to the property on County Road 200 North. They resume their tenant relationship with Holtzclaw, and the Chandlers vacate.
And they spend years pouring their labor into land they still do not legally own, maximizing its output, building their capital, until finally the definitive transaction occurs.
The big day.
On September 12, 1963, Herschel Holtzclaw signs the deed over to Wayne and Sarah Plunkett.
They finally transition from tenants to absolute owners. It's a massive economic leap. Think about renting your dream home, having to move out, watching someone else live there for years, and then finally coming back to buy the whole thing.
And once they secure the deed, they push the land to its absolute agricultural peak.
Oh, yeah. They establish a highly diversified, capitalized operation. And the focal point of it all is their Black Angus cattle herd.
But the physical toll of farming remains an absolute constant regardless of the century. On February 15, 1969, at the age of 55, Wayne is forced to halt operations due to failing health.
55 is young.
It is, but farming wears a body down.
So they host this massive public auction. The flyers distribute all across the county, and the itemized inventory of that sale provides just a stunning autopsy of what a 1960s agricultural operation actually entailed. It is a stark contrast to Eli Phillips swinging an axe in 1834.
Let's look at the mechanical engineering that replaced the ox and the axe. The lead item on the auction flyer is an International 706 tractor with a wide front and power steering, logging exactly 729 hours.
What does that specific machine represent in the evolution of farming? Because I'm not a tractor guy.
The International 706, which was introduced in the early 60s, is a huge paradigm shift in horsepower and hydraulic capability. It produced over 70 horsepower at the power takeoff, or PTO.
And what does that mean practically?
It meant you weren't just pulling a dead plow through the dirt. The tractor's engine was mechanically powering complex implements behind it. The wide front axle provided stability for heavy loader work, and the power steering, this is huge, meant the operator wasn't physically wrestling the steering column against the ruts of the field all day long.
That saves so much fatigue. They also list a 1952 M International and an ACWD tractor, so they are running a multi-tractor fleet.
Alongside a serious logistical fleet. A 1964 Ford F-100 half-ton pickup, and a 1949 Chevrolet 1.5-ton truck with a grain bed.
Because you need heavy hauling capacity to move the yields from the field to the grain elevator or the market. You're not using wagons anymore.
Right, and the implements listed are highly specialized. A John Deere four-row planter, a corn picker, a hay baler, a Kelly manure loader, a floating drag.
And each of those replaces, what, dozens of human laborers?
Easily. I mean, a four-row planter precisely spaces and buries seed across four rows simultaneously. It geometrically increases the acreage one man can plant in a single day. A floating drag is this heavy implement pulled across plowed soil to pulverize clods, level the surface, and prepare a fine seed bed.
And the manure loader?
It operates on hydraulic cylinders, replacing literally days of back-breaking shovel work with just a few hours of mechanical lifting.
The biological side of the ledger is equally impressive. The livestock inventory reveals the depth of their genetics program. They auction 7 bred Black Angus stock cows, pregnant with their 3rd calves, 1 bred cow with her 4th calf, a 2-year-old Black Angus bull, 6 Black Angus Springer heifers.
And for context, a Springer heifer is a young female cow that is pregnant with her 1st calf, and she's showing physical signs that she's close to springing or giving birth.
So they're about to drop a calf.
Exactly. These are highly valuable assets because they represent immediate future productivity for whoever buys them.
They also had 10 Black Angus feeder calves weighing 300 to 500 pounds. And think about the caloric fuel required to sustain this herd through an Indiana winter. 2,500 bushels of ear corn, 1,000 bales of mixed clover hay, and 600 bales of wheat straw.
The sheer volume of biological mass and mechanical steel sitting on that farm in 1969 is just a testament to the compounding effect of generations of labor. The land that took Eli Phillips years to clear by hand was now producing thousands of bushels of grain and supporting tons of premium beef.
But the human body fails before the land does.
Always.
The auctioneers sell off the equipment, the livestock is loaded onto trailers, and the heavy mechanization goes quiet. Wayne Plunkett lives another 13 years, farming on a heavily reduced scale until his death in 1982.
And Sarah outlives him by 17 years, maintaining ownership of the property until she passes away in 1999 at the age of 84.
And upon her death, the 80-acre plot that George Washington Turner bought with Martin Van Buren's signature is partitioned among the four surviving Plunkett children, Joy, Daryl, Beth, and Dixie.
The heart of the homestead, including the main farmhouse and the barns, goes to Joy. The land just adapts to the next generation.
Which brings us to the most enduring feature of the property, the Turner Cemetery. That tiny plot of earth where the four fought children who died of scarlet fever, their grandparents, and the Civil War soldier George P. Turner are all buried. It survived the 19th century land sales, it survived the heavy tractors of the 20th century, and it sits there today.
And the stewardship of that cemetery is really the ultimate connective tissue of this whole narrative. The Plunkett family, the descendants of the Quakers who arrived a century later, are the ones who maintain it.
That's beautiful.
They mow the grass, they protect the headstones, they are actively preserving the physical memory of the co-settlers who suffered the initial biological and psychological costs of breaking that specific piece of geography.
It transforms the entire concept of real estate into an ongoing shared heritage. We've traced this lineage from a frozen river in 1683 all the way to a modern family reunion. And there is one final unplanned chronological detail in these records that absolutely demands attention before we wrap up.
The dates.
The dates. We opened with the fact that George Phillips, the 1683 arrival, and Wayne Plunkett, the 1914 farmer, were both born on January 23rd, but the culmination of the land itself shares an identical echo.
Right.
The date that Wayne and Sarah Plunkett finally sat down with Herschel Holtzclaw and secured the absolute legal deed to the farm was September 12th, 1963.
The transition from tenants to owners.
The descendants of this 340-year narrative are actually gathering to celebrate this legacy, to hold a family reunion at Hunt Creek Farm, and the date of that reunion, September 12th. 2026.
Exactly 63 years to the day after the deed transferred.
It's an entirely organic coincidence. The family organizing the event did not engineer it, but the calendar just collapses the centuries.
It forces a massive paradigm shift in how we interact with the physical world, I think. We are conditioned to view land as a commodity, an asset to be leveraged, bought, and sold. But when you look at the sheer density of human experience layered into just 80 acres of Marion Township, you realize you do not own the land.
No, you are just the current custodian.
You are temporarily participating in a narrative that is vastly older than you. Who was the George Washington Turner of your specific neighborhood? Who was the 23-year-old who swung the axe to clear the exact spot where your foundation sits today, who endured unimaginable grief so that the grid could be laid out?
The land absorbs all of it.
It does. The history doesn't evaporate. It just gets built over.
It is a staggering ledger. Thank you for joining us as we explored the Phillips and Plunkett records. I hope the next time you walk across an empty field, or even just pull into your own driveway, you stop and consider the invisible layers beneath your feet.
The ghost of the frontier is still there, if you know how to look for them.
Until next time, keep digging into the history hidden right in front of you.